This week on RSBNB Update, in our fourth archaeology lore deep dive, we cover Warforge. What exactly was this deep cavern used for, and why is there a forge in it? We dig deep. Also, lore from the Karapak track, and all the news on Orthyn, which launches in 10 days. Plus, bot websites go down. This is RSBNB Update, episode 798, recorded Thursday, October 8th, 2020. The Lore Diggers. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. This week we are back, caught off the heels of last week's Mod Warden episode, and, you know, you'd think here that the temperature would go down, but the temperature is not going to go down until probably November here, because based on our scheduling, we have a back-to-back list of fun RS updates and fun RSBNB update episodes on the way. And, you know, we're kicking that off this week, continuing our archaeology lore series this week, talking about Warforge. And to do that, Diana and Sirion are here to join us, as they are for all of our past lore episodes. Welcome back, the both of you.
I think we need a team name. The four of us.
Don't make me think of a team name.
we've become a bit of a like close-knit team, like doing all these archaeology sites. I think we need a team name.
Oh, something will come at me at 3 a.m. and then I'll forget it as soon as I wake up. Little team.
Write it down if you got it. Write it down.
Yeah,
if you
exactly.
Got it.
Put like a little post-it next to your on your nightstand, and then write it down. No matter what time. And the next episode, I expect.
Oh,
name
no.
Of names.
We can go with the slogan, can you dig?
Can you dig it? The Lore Diggers. There you go!
Oh my god.
That's perfect, the Lore Diggers. But anyways, Tanis is also here, as he is each and every week. Tanis79, in-game, Dianima, Sirion, you can sound that one out. And I am, of course, Shane12088. And we're going to talk about Warforge, but, you know, we're going to at least be doing two more of these, you guys, because we still got to do Curadet. And have the announcement that Orthyn is launching on October 19th.
And here I thought that I was going to be done with you guys soon.
I thought I was going to be done with archaeology for a while, but no.
It's the gift.
I'm really close to getting it done with Karadet, and then Orphan starts at level 90, so I might be quite close to finishing that one already.
And see, the fun bit about that is that we already got Karadet done, so it's just a matter of producing the episode on that and putting it out. So it's not like, you know, we have to do a whole boatload of grinding here. I unfortunately didn't get to 110 to finish Warforge in time for this, but I'm gonna, you know, just cross my fingers and hope that there's nothing in this last mystery that I haven't read yet that I need to go over. But, you know, Warforge is the Bandosian dig site. Zanik is the site manager, which raised some questions when we saw who that was, given her backstory having been dead in the past from the quest. And, you know, with that, Bandos is also dead, and this is the first god of any of the dig sites that we've seen that doesn't really have an existence in RuneScape anymore. And, you know, it kind of puts a bit of a different spin on it, I felt. And, you know, did you guys, and, you know, this is approaching this from a very high altitude on this one, did you guys feel that Warforge felt slightly more disconnected than the rest of the dig sites did?
I don't know what you mean to disconnect it.
Well, basically, in such a way that everything that they were talking about happened so long ago, and everything was stone, whereas now, if you go to Curadet or Everlight, you have things that have actually been restored or in working order.
I think I see what you mean there. This is the one that's pure history.
Yes.
Everything else has some kind of impact on the present day. So Karadet, you get a reveal of a very major new character that I'm not going to spoil in this one because that's going to be a big reveal for the next one. Infernal Source, you get a whole new skill. Well, a subset of a skill, you get Ancient Summoning. Everlight, you get, I suppose, the Everlight.
Yeah.
Then you interact with that, and there's some kind of present day thing there. And then you get Ancient Invention, obviously, from Stormguard. This one is just entirely historical.
Yeah, and that's what I was going for with that.
Yeah, this is kind of my least favorite one, I have to say. Not really in a negative way, but mostly because I don't care about Bandos. And I find him a very difficult character to get enthusiastic about. So yeah, this was an interesting sight for me.
I wouldn't say this is my least favorite side. I wouldn't say I care about Bandos, but I can kind of respect Bandos because he's very just straight and honest, right? He just, you know, he believes in the power of the strongest person or thing, which is very simple, and there's no politics behind that. And, you know, if you talk to, like, Armadale or Saradomin, they're like, oh, but we believe in the power of good and law. But also, they sort of decide what is good and what is law. So there's always that shadiness. Whereas Bandos, you know, you always knew what you could expect with that guy. And
that's the flip side of his character, that he's never pretended to be anything else than what he is.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
throughout what we've learned about him, I got to respect him more and more because of that. And actually, I find it kind of sad how Warforge is throwing it out of the water and like, hey, here are two goblins and they're continuously whacking each other with a big stick to entertain the war god. Which, like, of all the dick sites, like, all the dick sites seem to have added a layer of depth to that, like a group of people or a god or something. Whereas here, that depth was not here. Like, it felt very bland. Just, you know, people whacking other people with things.
Until you get to the Zanuck bit.
I would disagree with any. It's not a shallow site. I wouldn't say it's as deep as the other ones, but. Especially when you get to the really high level stuff, like the final mysteries, the level 110 lore drops.
Yeah, okay.
That depth is there. But, I've spent the least amount of time here. I don't want to do it down because visually, it's really impressive and it's got that sense of scale that all these sites have, but this one does it in a very interesting and slightly unusual way.
Well, let's dive right in then.
Let's just keep going with it.
You know, level 76, you unlock this one, and the first mystery that you uncover with this is the first commander, which, I mean, that's what Warforge was. It was always this training area where goblins go in and then they come out ready for war, and that's effectively what we're learning about with Warforge. Is there any background info you wanted to cover before we go into this first mystery?
Yeah, so the background info we got about this site is, because this is all fresh and we don't really know a lot about Bandos in the Third Age, like all the other sites were kind of building on lore apart from the Armadale one, I think, that we had sort of heard of. This is all very new. Most of it is from the journal or the letters that the archaeology letters we got kind of as the pre-release.
Right.
Where we had that note from Zanuck to Tony saying that this is the site where Bandos staged gladiatorial combat between goblins in order to sell off the strongest survivors as mercenaries to the other gods during the Third Age. And at the end of the Third Age, before he was banished by Guthix, he collapsed the tunnels and trapped everything inside. But some managed to get out somehow. And there's your first question. How did that happen? And then when you look at the opening cutscene, like whenever you first talk to Zanuck, you get a nice little opening cutscene with some voice acting. And the kind of questions that this site addresses, there's two or three. There's where were Bandos' mercenaries trained? And this is, you know, this is the site. The second question is, the armaments that are found here don't look like typical goblin weapons. They don't look like typical Bandosian weapons, so where did they come from? And why is the secret, in quotes, so well buried? So kind of, yeah, what was down here? Why do the weapons that these goblins have not look like the ones you usually do? And how has it stayed hidden all this time? that's kind of the general shape of the story.
And that's enough of a jumping off point, I think. For the site, because I think, and this is what I was going to get at with this, is that when it comes down to it, Vandos was killed in World Event 2, and as a result of that, he didn't have the benefit of all the character development that we've seen throughout the tail end of the 6H series. And perhaps that's a bit unfortunate that we're looking at this through this extra historical lens that the god this Ixite was around isn't actually here anymore. And with that, I think that's another thing that applies that full historical lens that I was talking about and why this site just feels different.
So can I ask a question as a bit of a lore noob? Maybe I missed something, or maybe it's a plot hole, which would be exciting. So If Vandos used this site to train soldiers and commanders, I guess, and then sold them off as mercenaries, wasn't he himself a faction in the God War?
There was a bit of both. So he himself had factions of goblin type races, so the ogres and the orcs and goblins as well. They formed his forces, and then the goblins, specifically the goblins, or the ones that he sold.
Oh, interesting.
I think there's a difference. So he was kind of both, but yes, and I think Saradomin and Zamorek are the ones that are named as buying these legions of goblins off him. Don't know if Armadil did.
Interesting.
But yeah, you're right. He was kind of, and again, I suppose that highlights the hypocrisy of the other gods in a way that Vandos has never been hypocritical. Going back to what you were saying just now, Sirion.
I just find it weird that you would sell mercenaries to the people you're fighting. Like,
hey, in war, anything that makes a buck is a good thing to do.
Yeah, and then it says somewhere, I think in the Archaeology Journal as well, that he used the money to build weapons of war. So it's kind of how he funded his armies.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's a good question.
All right. Are we going to go through this and take the way where we move through the site graphically, covering all the various mysteries and researches that were there, and also cover a bit about the looks of it, like we did with the previous
ones? Yeah, I'd like to do that. It's a little bit more difficult with this site because it is a bit more back and forth.
Yeah.
in the Crucible, there's low-level and high-level sites. There's a lot of jumping between the areas as you level up, which you don't get in some of the other sites. So I'm going to go sort of area, but I'm going to go the Crucible first, then the tunnels, then the forge.
All right, sounds good. And, you know, I think one important thing to talk about with this is that as soon as you get into the Crucible, it's very claustrophobic.
This is something what I was saying about how they use the grandeur and the scale of these new sites in a very different way. This one's vertical. Compare it to Everlight, which is very expansive and very landscape. This is a really vertical environment, and it feels so close, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, claustrophobic, I'd say. I find it quite difficult to actually look around to get a good sense of it.
And, you know, until I got into the second part, I was like, this is not going to be good. And, you know, even when you do get into the later sections of it, it still is claustrophobic compared to everything else. But that's a topic for later on.
I found an interesting distinction, though, when I was looking at Warforged from kind of a accessibility point of view, where you're looking at just the visual characteristics of a place, and it's made to be small, so you do get that claustrophobic, but the art and the assets in it make it look, you would think it has this like cluttered feel, right? But the clutter doesn't actually get in the way of the gameplay, so I think it actually works out really well.
You're right. The effect it, the effect it has is actually it is very effective. The kind of the balance between you do feel like you're trapped in a very small area, but you can still kind of look around and navigate and move through it.
Yeah, that makes
in a
sense.
Realistic kind of
that
way.
Makes sense. Pathfinding wasn't that difficult, I don't think, on this one, so that's good. It's not an anachronia, but. Let's dive into the first researches and mysteries at the Crucible, because after you get down here at level 76, like you said, there's a range. You have some excavation sites that are level 76, and then there's some that are even higher here, and, you know, you start collecting things as soon as you begin.
Yeah, so the first thing you... I'm going to start with the research point, the research melting point, which talks about what the Crucible is. It says, only goblin remains have been discovered within the Warforge's Crucible arena. Other artifacts suggest this arena was used to teach goblin warfare, but it wasn't exactly safe and only the fittest goblins survived. So this is your gladiatorial arena with Vandals' throne overlooking, and he's watching these goblins fight to the death for his own entertainment.
Yeah, and I think there's even blood on the ground. Or at least
there's
stains.
Blood, there's skeletons, there's cages and chains. Like, it's another really brutal area.
I think this is as close as you'd ever get to having a torture chamber in RS, perhaps, with all the chains.
Yeah, and a bit of that
cages.
Comes up again in the first mystery, the first commander, which is quite a long one, so I'm not going to go into really detail about it. I've
sure.
put a link to the wiki transcript in the notes.
All right.
But it's from the perspective of the first Dorgishan champion, and that's important because that's what Zanik is. Zanik is a Dorgishan champion. Yep. She is the chosen commander of Vandos at the moment, in the same way that this person was. And it kind of describes how the Crucible Games, which is what happened in this arena, are based on traditions from the 12 goblin tribes, but taken to a really brutal and lethal level. And yeah, they were designed to be kind of fights to the death in the end. Some of the descriptions get almost a bit like saw-like, like chained heat was particularly gruesome, I thought, describing how four goblins would be chained together by the neck and then they'd have to try and kill the other teams and they would win, with, you know, two living and two dead.
Yeah.
And yeah, really quite brutal stuff going on in here.
And, you know, I never thought RS would get to that point, but I guess it did in the history. And, you know, we were kind of brought into tune with this when we got the, you know, the rundown of what Warforge was actually about. And when you read into this, you know, it doesn't look that gruesome on the surface, but when you read into it, it is really, really gruesome.
Yeah, and it kind of highlights Vandos' cruelty and what kind of a creature he was. It's quite interesting. The writer is called Zeelhart, or she gets named Zeelhart by Vandos. Again, she's Dorgish, and she doesn't really want to be there. The quote is, she just wants to graduate from this place and go home. So she creates these games in order to please Vandos, so, you know, he might let her go. But also kind of semi-tries and fails quite a lot in protecting the goblins that are going to be affected by them. This wasn't a very nice one to read, not going to lie.
No, and, you know, you can also tell based on some of the implements that you get from the dig sites around here, too, in terms of what you excavate, you know. War tethers, for example. That's the first one that you excavate. Then there's the Hobdegob ball, which, you know, I took as a something used in as an implement to kill other goblins that were obviously chained.
Yeah, so that was
here.
That's kind of one where it's based on a tradition from one of the tribes where they'd play it almost like a football game. It was like a ball game. So Bandos said, right, let's make that out of solid rubber and put spiked metal in it.
Yep.
And you can use it to kill other goblins. Like, that's the kind of stuff that was going on here. So taking historical tribal traditions and using them to kill other goblins. So yeah, not nice stuff at all.
No.
That might make baseball a little more interesting, though.
Tennis!
Yeah.
But it's interesting what you say about the difference with this site being that the god is dead. I can kind of imagine what Bandos would say about this. Like, he's trying to build an army, and I think he would claim that he's making the goblins stronger by doing all of this. Like, that would be his reasoning behind it.
Yeah, it's that very strict drill sergeant taken to the 10th level, right?
Mm.
So.
But yeah, absolutely merciless and absolutely pitiless.
Yeah. All right. And see, and this is what we talked about here is that, you know, we're not going to go through the entire text of the transcript on here, but this is the general gist of it. And this is just the tip of the Warforged dig site. After this, you're presented with another door that you need to get through, and that's the Crucible mystery. And I wanted to get started on that as soon as I was there, but you have to wait a little bit for that, don't you?
I think that's got a slightly higher level requirement.
Yeah, it's 83. And, you know, just while we're talking about Warforge here, as soon as you begin, you can actually start collecting these chunks of Imkando metal, which was an interesting thing for the
Imkando that's another Imkando slight pit. Hook of what are we actually going to find down here.
Yeah. And, you know, the only other time Imkando was used when there was a Dragonkin Forge. But, of course, we'll get to the Forge later on this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what's next?
So, out of the Crucible is the mystery going into the tunnels. Before we go into the tunnels, I want to cover a couple of the higher level research and mystery things that you find towards, I think, 105 to 110 here. So Power Behind the Throne is where you can actually investigate the throne itself. There's a little recess where you can put a sculpture that you find later on in the dig site into the wall, and it unlocks something, but you can't go through it. And this is what goes into the You Have Chosen mystery. So these things kind of run onto each other, the three here.
Yeah.
So if you try to enter the room after putting in the sculpture, a voice says champions only, and it's kind of Bandos' voice saying, no, you can't go in there.
And we know who's a champion?
Bandos? You go talk to Zanuck.
Yep. And this was where it got really interesting for me. I think this was the one, but I'll let you continue.
Yeah, so if you go back to Zanuck and give her a restored Dorgishan spear, again, this is another artifact you can find later on in the site, she will agree to come down and try to open the wall. And she does. And yeah, and then you can access a little hidden chamber literally behind the throne. And this is where you get the big high war chest research, which is actually a little bit of a lore drop about Bandos himself.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that Bandos left this place in something of a hurry, but he left behind a number of Kalikra artifacts. Our researchers suggest that the Kalikra were a tribe from which Bandos originated before his ascension. So now we know what Bandos is. Something we didn't actually know before.
And at this point, you know, you have to wonder if killing off gods is a good thing, because there's just so much lore that you could go into to discover these kind of things. And, you know, if he was alive, you could have done it in a quest. But now you have to do it in the archaeology skill. Does anyone feel shortchanged about that? That, you know, perhaps Bandos departed us a little bit too soon? I'm not speaking from the sense of the narrative. I'm just speaking from the game design, Jagex sense.
Well, I'm anti-killing off gods because it defeats the whole idea. But it's hard because that was actually the best world event. But they didn't have to. I guess we could have done it some other way, right?
I mean,
they didn't kill off at the end of World Event 1, did they?
It was World Event 2 they killed them off.
Yeah. But I'm glad they did. I think it was a good decision to make.
Interesting.
I mean, it showed they were serious about it, right? That's sort of the advantage you get. Like, it shows that the gods don't have plot armor on.
Yeah, and it kind of emphasizes that gods, I'm going to put that in quotes, you can't see me doing quote fingers, but I'm doing quote fingers, that gods in RuneScape, or most of them, aren't actually kind of what a real life interpretation of a god is. They are mortal.
That's the elder gods that we're talking about then.
They can be killed. Gods can be killed. And that adds a really interesting layer to it. And it also, like, for Armadil's character development, it was really cool. Here's this god of justice and peace.
You're right.
Killing off another god. That's also, a catalyst.
But that's then they left it all away with Tuska. Like, so yeah, at that point it seemed like choices meant something. There was a tangible direction, but does anyone really think?
How do you think they threw it away with Tuska?
Because it was clearly mean, I don't want to rehash old stuff, but I don't think there was any question in the outcome of that.
Okay, yeah, that's very true. But I think it's a slightly different scenario with Tusker, or the stakes of the Tusker event.
All right. Yeah,
plus, I feel they killed off Bandos and can say, like, oh, now we don't get to go into the lore of Bandos. We're not going to run out of lore anytime soon anyway.
No, I was just saying that it was an interesting angle that could have been pursued.
And I would argue that there have been a couple of really good Bandos quests that don't involve him. The Mighty Fall, in particular, was a fantastic Bandos quest. And it didn't involve him at all. It involved his followers dealing with the death of their god. That's a great catalyst for story.
You're right.
In my opinion.
You're right.
That was a really good quest.
You're right. All right. Diversion. Diversion averted. Let's get back to Warforge.
Totally worth it.
Let's get back to Warforge.
I think that's all we have in the Crucible.
Yep. That sounds
that's
about
the
right.
Opening area. So if we head down into the tunnels...
Yeah, and this is, of course, the main section of the dig site. It opens up quite a bit. There's a stream underground. There's a necrite rock, which is part of one of the mysteries. Or was that a mystery? Getting all the keys?
It gets involved in one of the mysteries. You have to mine it to uncover a key for to get into the forge.
And then there's the cave fish as well. Okay, it was the keys for the forge. We'll get there.
Yeah.
All right.
I really liked how this area looked. It kind of combines the kind of feeling like you're underground and feeling like you're trapped with a bit more expansiveness. And I really like the color scheme they've got here. Kind of the sickly green of the river and kind of that green tint goes all the way through it. I think it looks really, really good.
Yeah, and they had to do that. They had to do that because otherwise it just would have been browns, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's got that really nice kind of acid pop on it. I feel that it just looks really good.
Yeah, and you know, you're going to be spending a lot of time at Warforge when you start doing Red Rum 3 and 4. For Tetra
Tetra farming down here. Down here you basically find a lot of information about what happened after Bandos collapsed the entrance to the forge. What happened to the goblins that were left behind. So Northside is the first bit of research about that. It says the chambers, the north part of these tunnels, are littered with barricades and signs of a skirmish. So you've got an armory, a sparring area, and a ritual area to the big high war god, which is what the goblins called Bandos. There's evidence that there was a great deal of fighting in these tunnels. So you get the implication that basically they all turned on each other. As soon as the tunnels were collapsed, you've got 12 goblin tribes all fighting each other down here.
What a mess. What a mess.
Yeah, and that gets expanded on in the Forge War mystery, which is from the perspective of one of the goblins trapped down here. I won't read it out because it's quite long again. But yeah, basically all 12 tribes started fighting each other. And the reason they're doing that is because they treated it as the final game of Bandos and said when one tribe wins, he will come back and set us free because that's our only way out of here. So they were expecting Bandos to come back, and obviously he never did. But that's why they were fighting.
Now, does that highlight on the goblins and whatnot that they were they either ingrained and trained to do this, or was this just part of their, I guess, DNA to do this?
I think it would be because they've been down here and Bandos has been training them to act like this and to kill like this.
All right.
What
else would they do?
Yeah.
Like, that's their entire life has been in service of Bandos, and if that slips away, you know, what do you do then? So, I can totally understand that.
Yeah, and I think it's quite sad, to be honest.
Yeah, because when you put this in your mind about what some of the text in this mystery says, you know, it says that food was getting scarce. The water might not be safe to drink. And they think that they are on a test, but this just shows their faith to Bandos, that they thought he was going to come back when this was all said and done. And the fact he didn't, you know, I guess talks about what Bandos really stood for, right?
Yeah, again, it's his cruelty.
Yeah, exactly.
And his absolute pitiless nature. It also mentions another character, Mr. Dwarf. And again, here's your second mention of a dwarf. We've got the Imkando metals. We've got the thing that there's unusual weapons down here. So this is more developing more on the core mystery of this site, is what's this mention of a dwarf doing down here? He won with weapons. So he's the one who's making their weapons.
Interesting. Do we know if he got out?
This is what we find out later on.
Okay.
So yeah, at this stage, we know there's a dwarf down here. We know there's 12 trapped tribes. We don't actually, we do know at the start in the journal, Zanuck said that some got out. So I think the mystery here now, or the story here, is how did they get out? Because some did survive this.
Right.
So what you do here is you go into the forge, which is where you collect 12 keys, each representing a goblin tribe, and use it to unlock the doors to the forge. This is where you do lots of activities around the area. So you do the fishing, you do the mining, you go down some of the tunnels and just do something down there. I think some of them are just random drops as well.
Yeah, some of them are just random drops from excavating down there.
From excavating. And
I excavated about 500 malachite green or so in terms of getting one of the keys, because I didn't have access to one of the sites down here, but I had access to the tunnels, and I could excavate the green down there. So that was fun, you know, doing that for a while.
I did quite like how they included malachite green, because that's quite a famous toxic green pigment, and I feel like it fit very nicely with the...
Yeah, and when you think about it, maybe that's what's dyeing the river green.
I think that would be what would be dyeing the river green. Like, I looked at malachite a lot when I was doing my research project at university.
Oh, really?
It was one of the pigments I did a lot of work on. So it was nice to see that mentioned.
Fascinating.
But yeah, very toxic. You don't want to drink it, that's for sure.
And we catch cavefish in it that we then cook and sell on the Grand Exchange.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
You think lead in the water's bad? Just wait till you got malachite green in the water.
Nice.
Tastes like freedom to me.
It's seasoning. It's just seasoning.
All right. What's next?
I think there's one more mystery that we cover here called Too Many Bones. And that basically just gives a little description of what kind of areas you find down here, because there's quite a few.
Yeah.
So in the south of the Warforge consists of sleeping areas, a cramped dorm for most of the goblins, a luxury boudoir for the current champion, and a series of pens for various animals and their keepers. So just a little bit more description of the actual areas you find down here.
And, you know, when you talk about it and you look at all the other dig sites and you think, which of the dig sites is the most beautiful represented in game? To me, that's Everlight. Second, Stormguard. But if you think about it, which would be the most interesting to set up in real life to shoot for a movie, for example? To me, that's Warforge.
I remember, Sirion, you said for Everlight you felt like it was very empty and it felt very gameplay focused. How do you feel about this site in comparison?
I think Warforge is my favorite site. It's...
Oh, really? Like
both visually, I find it's stunning, especially the Crucible, right? It's, like we said, it's claustrophobic. But what I really appreciate about it is how they mix that aesthetic with something that's very functional gameplay-wise as well. I think if you look at Warforge as a site, as an achievement of putting something in the game that is both beautiful and, you know, fits the gameplay, I think Warforge is, you know, the golden standard they should be aiming for all content.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yeah, and I knew this a long time ago that this was his favorite site, but I didn't tell anyone that, and I'm glad that he surprised you all with that. And, you know, what I just said might have been a bit of a setup to relay that, but All right, let's move on then, because, you know, obviously Into the Forge unlocks the forge, which you need to make the Imkandomatic. And, you know, I think that I realize this is deviating a bit from lore, but when this first came out, there were people who spent hours upon hours trying to get the fish, and apparently it was bugged, and it was one thing that they didn't add a guaranteed chance to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I think I must have started it after that happened, because I got these keys quite quickly.
Yeah, just a bit of a tidbit on that. But I think we go into the forge next, if we're looking at
that area.
Yeah,
so after the mysteries and research for the actual tunnels, next part you go into is the forge itself. Bear with me a second. I am following along in-game, just so I can talk about the visuals a bit better.
Sure. Yeah, and, you know, this is something else that we really haven't talked about with these dig sites, is that when you look at Warforge compared to all of the other ones, it is perhaps the most constrained in terms of the area that it feels like it occupies from the foot, but it's a whole lot more vertical than that. And do you guys think that with the research and mysteries we've talked about so far, Warforge is living up to what it has been presented as? Visually, that is, when you tie it to the mysteries?
I think it fits. Nothing about this site felt jarring to me. It was all very consistent, and it was all very... It all flowed from one bit to the other. Everything made sense within the site.
All right.
There was no tonal jars to me, which I thought was really good. But yeah, the visual look of it and how it's put together and constructed kind of from a level design point of view, I think it does work and it fits, I think.
Okie dokie.
And just hopping into the forge now. It's a little bit awkward because there's two sets of doors to the forge, and the one I was just by is still locked, and I need to go and open it from the other side. So I had to run all the way around the other side of the building there for a second.
And the forge is one of the teleport points that you can get to when you dive in.
Oh, yeah, so it is. I forgot about that.
Whoopsie. That's why the other door is open to me, because I used it a lot to get... Because it's closer than the tunnel teleport point to most of the sites, so...
Ah, right. So, yeah, basically, you get into the forge, and surprise, this is a dwarven, and specifically an Imkandodwarven forge. And Imkando dwarfs were the Sarodominous dwarves of the Third Age. Modern survivors is obviously Thurgo, who loves his redberry pies. We all love him. They are legendary smiths. So what's Wad doing down here? We know Bandos only worked with the goblin races. What's a Sarodominous dwarf doing down here with this enormous industrial forge?
He was obviously paid enough, and he's there all by his own accord. Right.
Yeah. No.
Really? I thought goblins were really good at making redberry pies. Like, that's what they're known for, right? Goblins, redberry pies. Isn't that their whole thing?
Oh, dear. No, surprisingly. Dwarven Forge is the research you find down here. The research team has discovered that the forge beneath the crucible is of Imkando construction. Evidence points to a kidnapped Imkando dwarf being taken prisoner and forced to smith weapons at the forge, among other things. This is expanded on in Heart of the Forge, which is the final and highest level lore drop of the site. It's a series of letters between the dwarf, who is Thalmond, and his wife, Killy. And he kind of explains what's happened to him. He's been kidnapped by dwarves and brought down here. And Bandos is saying, you make me weapons or you die. And he, you know, goes along with that because the alternative isn't very nice. And builds this industrial weapons production facility down here. And this is what the Warforge is actually named after. It is that this whole area is named after this forge. Again, it's quite long, so I've put a link to the transcript in the notes.
And what would you say the main gist of this mystery that people should take away from this is, aside from the fact that it's a Sarodominous dwarf running this forge?
It's quite an interesting one. It's a multi-parter, and each one kind of has a different theme. So the first one is kind of the context. that he's been kidnapped and they want him to build a production line, and he's going to go along with it because he doesn't want to die.
Solid motivation.
Yeah, solid motivation there. Second one is a little bit more about goblins. Yeah, kind of related to what we were saying earlier. He says he sympathizes with them, and no wonder they're so violent and ruthless, because the god here breeds them to be. He's talked to some of the new arrivals, and they're almost sweet in a rough around the edges kind of way. So goblins aren't naturally like that.
Yeah, and we've seen that in some of the quests, too.
They're taught to do this.
And we've seen that in some of the early quests, too.
Yeah. Third one is how he... Because Bandos wanted him to use bronze, and obviously bronze against steel isn't very good, he actually developed a new kind of bronze.
Warforged bronze. Yeah,
which is one of the materials you get down here. And then the last one is the really interesting one, and this is the resolution and the payoff of the story. So Bandos has collapsed the tunnels, trapped all the goblins down here, and, you know, they're all fighting, still playing his violent games. It's turned into a war zone. They've left the dwarf alone because they're kind of in awe of him, or he's all of their ally. They come and knock on his doors, trading information and supplies for more weapons. And in return, he's been stockpiling the peat that he's been finding down here, grinding it to a powder, and he's developing explosives. So what he wants to do is basically blast his way out and take the goblins with him and free them by getting back to the surface that way. And that's where it ends. And I think we can assume that, due to what Zanuck said and how the goblins got out and survived, that he succeeded. And I like to think he made his way back to Killy, because that's a nice happy ending.
Yeah, and, you know,
but we don't know.
Everything else about Warforge is very, very dark and very gruesome. And it would be nice to have, you know, there's this one happy ending associated with it. Was anybody else hoping that maybe we might be able to take this recipe of explosives and use it somewhere? That this might have been something we would have found?
That would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
I don't know whether you can actually make explosives with peat, but yeah, it would be fun to take it into a, I don't know, would that
I
be
I don't have enough chemistry to answer that. I do know that you can... if you concentrate peat well enough, you can turn it into a fuel and burn it.
Yeah, it's a typical fuel source in some parts of the world.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, maybe.
The Netherlands.
Oh, is that what you use?
Really? You guys are still using that?
Not anymore, but the area I'm from originally in the Netherlands is known for its peat.
Yeah, Ireland and Scotland still use it quite a lot. I think Wales do, to be honest, as well.
We don't anymore, but we have large, like, you can see it in, like, the place names and all that stuff. Like, it's, like, all the stuff there is centered around it was a big, big deal. So, yeah.
Sounds like you guys need a clean energy strategy of some sort, but that's
we don't use it anymore.
Oh, you don't? I thought you said you did.
No.
Okay, good.
No. It used to be a big deal, and the area used to be known for it, but
not
anymore.
Anyways, we could talk about energy all we want here, but Diana, let's go through the note. We didn't go about the note of Vandos' cruelty. Do you want me to read that out, or do you want to read it from the site?
Hang on, is that the one from Heart of the Forge?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one I've already talked about with how goblins, when they come into the site, they're not bloodthirsty warriors.
Yeah, I just want to read the actual text from it.
Yeah, go for it.
Provide a bit of a background to the story here. It says, "Don't get me wrong. I've fought and killed my fair share of goblins in various wars. They're fierce opponents, no question. Merciless. But seeing them here in this place, I can't help but feel sorry for them, sympathize even. No wonder they are so violent and ruthless. This god here breeds them to be. But I've talked to some of the new arrivals, the youngsters. They're almost sweet and rough around the edges sort of way." And, you know, I think when it comes down to Warforge at the end of the day and talking about it, do you think that this is the thing to take away from this? Is that... well, actually, three things with this. One, that the goblins aren't like this when they come in. Two, it was all due to conditioning by Bandos. And three, there was a nice Ceridominus dwarf trying to provide light at the end of the day and allow those to escape who were trapped in here. And what does that say for, you know, the Bandos Ceridoman dynamics?
Yeah, I wonder if it's safe to extrapolate at all from that. Again, Bandos is dead now, so I don't really see how much of an impact it has.
Yeah, or are we just, you know, reading too much into it? Because, you know, that's what I would say. I'd say this is one of the classic things where, you know, we've seen time and time again in game that Ceridominism is positioned as the modern, the real world equivalent to Catholicism. And that's...
Ooh, I wouldn't say Catholicism.
No? Okay.
No, I'd say Zoroastrianism is that kind of thing. But yeah, you're right. It's kind of a Christianity type thing.
Right.
Catholicism specifically. I could talk about this a lot, but I'm not going to. But yeah, no, you're right. It's kind of it's light. It's good.
Right,
it's,
Christianity. I was kind of extrapolating there. I went one level lower than I should have. But that's the thing. It's always associated with light in real life, Christianity, that is. And that was at least what we've been led to believe. Ceridominism is based on in-game. And could that be the thing that is the big thing to take away from the end of Warforged here?
I'm not sure whether it's a big thing, but yes, it is something. It is something. But yeah, that's kind of the only payoff we really got in this site. It's not nearly as big as or as impactful as some of the other ones.
It would have been nice if there had been more Imkando secrets that we could have uncovered here.
That would have been really fun, yeah, wouldn't it?
Some nice rewards.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe. You get the level 80 pickaxe. Or sorry, mallet.
Yeah,
for free,
but I didn't really feel like I had to work for that.
No.
Oh, the Imkando mattock.
Yeah, well, like, sure, I had to activate a bunch of stuff there, but I didn't really feel like I worked to uncover the knowledge to make it. Like, they could have done a lot with that, but it was not the focus of the site, let's be honest. Like, the focus of the site was, you know, the goblins, and I think we got a lot from that.
What does it mean for Zanuck at the end of this site? Because it seems like she's just
really
the attendant there. Yeah.
Zanuck's always an interesting one for me. I like her a lot. I like what they've done with her story. But I think it would be difficult for them to have a real story-related conclusion for her because of how varied her story is through quest lines. Like you're saying at the start, sometimes she's dead. Sometimes she's off on the home world.
It's just very confusing when you think about it.
She's all over the place, depending on when you talk to her. So I suppose they couldn't really bring in any kind of lore bombshell here about her specifically, because it could get tangled up with the rest of her story so easily and cause problems there.
Because if you compare this to the attendant at Everlight, there's a huge difference there.
Yeah. But even Vanessa didn't get that much of a payoff. Like, she just got her nightlight turned down a little bit.
Yeah. and a bit of a rundown of what happened in the past on that. So...
Yeah, but that's all I really have for Warforged. There's not nearly as much as some of the other sites, and obviously not nearly as much as Kared Et. Like, oh my god,
no,
we've got a lot to talk about with that one.
And more than just
all of them can be used in that sense.
More than just inside Kared Et, and more that actually goes into the entire archaeology skill on that. So, I don't know, and this is why Warforged just feels like a bit of an odd one to me. I don't have much to say about it either. I think the thing that players enjoy Warforged for is the Red Rum Relic series and farming Tetracompass pieces when it comes down to it at the end of the day.
Well, I can't speak for everybody, but I mean, this was my favorite one too.
And really?
Yeah. I just feel like this is the first place that I've been that it feels grindable. Like,
I thought you meant from the lore
familiar.
Or something on that.
No, I mean, it's the only one that the lore in of itself is the payoff. So, like, Well, I guess the Matic too. I enjoyed going for the Matic. It took me forever. But yeah, no. I
think I had all my pieces by 84.
Oh wow! Yeah.
How about you guys?
I don't remember, but I remember that when I wanted it, I had it. Had it for a while. So
took me quite a while.
I think I was closer
to
90. I think for the before I had all the stuff.
All right.
Keys, I think.
Any other questions or comments about Warforged? Because you know, I like you, Diana. See this as a very surface level one, and I really didn't have much else to say on this either. Sirion, Tanis?
How are we going to see more? What are we going to see next in this story? What do you think?
I don't know. It's difficult to tell. I would personally love to see more Dorishan quests. I'd love to see another Zanit quest. But her story might be done. I did enjoy the Mighty Fall. I thought that was such a good quest. Like, so really unexpected and really, really fun. I do want to emphasize that this isn't a... When I say this is my least favorite, and when I say I don't have much to say about it, that doesn't mean it's a bad bit of content.
Oh, like, yeah, absolutely not.
Like, from what you guys saying about it, it is visually and atmospherically, it is so, so good.
Yeah. You know, one thing I'd recommend is, you know, if you don't have a good pair of speakers... play Warforged with headphones on.
Oh gosh, yeah. Again, the music is just wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's maybe even my favorite soundtrack as well.
And, you know, when you're just excavating along, you would, you know, expect there to be, you know, no other noises. But, you know, this is supposed to be an area where everyone is dead, but you can still hear random thumps and thuds.
Yeah, it's very atmospheric, this site. And yeah, it was quite fun. I just, compared to the other ones, it was the last one on my list. And that doesn't make it bad necessarily. It's just in terms of my priorities and what I enjoy in gameplay, it just happened to come at the bottom.
Yeah, that's fine. All right. Well,
and I don't care about Bandos, so.
Yeah. And you know, in some ways this is saving it all for Coredet too. And, presumably
you guys are hyping it up. It's going to be hard to make true on all the hype you're giving me.
I am 500k XP off being able to finish Coredet, and I am so excited because I know what happens and I know who we get to meet.
I have already finished it as well, and I can tell you that it is worth the wait.
I'm really hyped.
Yep.
No one else probably will be, but I am.
No. And if anything, this Diana could be an episode where Sirion and Tanis go to sleep and we'll just talk about it for a couple hours.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
But Sirion not being able to shut up and be me who can't shut up. Yay!
But, you know, with archaeology, it goes on. And, you know... you know, we're on the archaeology bent. Let's do Orthon first. I was initially going to do the Karapaktrak lore first, but let's do Orthon first. Let's keep on the archaeology bent, then we'll come back to Karapaktrak.
That sounds good to me.
After this, Orthon, we got the date. Will be October 19th. This will feature. You know,
we've got only 10 days. Blimey.
Yeah. We thought it was going to be at the top end of Anachronia, but it turns out that we're actually going to be seeing it. At the Anachronia base camp is going to be where most of the excavations are going to happen.
Huh. Yeah, that surprised me.
I thought they were going to say it's all over the island and they're going to have a new way to go around.
No.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Something about having a new way to get around.
Well, there is going to be a new way to get around, but most of the excavations will be at the base camp from what I interpreted off the live stream.
I was under the impression it will be all over the island, but...
Eight mysteries.
10 Yay. Excavation spots, 22 new artifacts, and 5 new materials.
That's really cool. Exciting. So what's the faster way to go around going to be? I'm personally
riding
hoping
for dinosaur.
I'm hoping for zip lines.
I'm hoping that you get to sit on a T-Rex and just go clomping through the jungle.
Fly a pterosaur.
Yeah.
secret skill launch mounting.
Sweet.
Yeah, and you know, it'll start at level 90 archaeology, go up to 120, all the various unlocks. And you know, another fun little tidbit about this is they say that you might also want to complete Desperate Measures, which will help you with some of the later areas.
That implies that I just remember when we were looking at Desperate Measures, there were a couple of areas where you were predicting this is going to be in archaeology. It looks like you're going to be right.
Yeah.
That wonderful bit place with the node on.
Yeah. And
I wonder because like if they put sites behind the quest requirements, they are putting mysteries behind these quest requirements.
You might want to have completed Desperate Measures.
Yeah, so it won't be a hard requirement.
No. I'm hoping that it's a hard requirement because it means we can, like, the mysteries could build on, you know, those sleeping dragonkin. I don't know the names. I don't remember the names. But those sleeping dragonkin, you know, maybe we'll end up helping them out as part of these mysteries. You know, there's so... I think there's a lot of cool things.
They could probably include that without putting it behind a hard quest requirement, like that you could easily do, you know, two pieces of dialogue, or even just when you talk to someone for an explanation of the scenario, if you forget about it, even you could have a dialogue option that you press that just gives you a quick overview of what these people are.
Fair enough. Removes that reveal, but
yeah,
I guess realistically you could do Desperate Measures without ever having heard of Dragonkin, really. So
yeah.
Oh no, you're right that the sites will be spread across Anachronia. It's just that the site manager will be at base camp. Sorry about that.
Site manager is Dr. Hang on, no wait, I got excited about the wrong character there. Mr. Mordeau is the site manager, is that right?
Yes.
And then the collector is the one I'm excited about. It's Sharagan, who we met in One of a Kind, and she is Hanavis's great-great-great-something granddaughter. One of the younger dragon riders that have come over from Aya as one of the pioneers. And we're going to talk a bit more about that, about the Yak Track lore drops. We'll talk about that more in a bit. But it'd be nice to see her again.
Yeah. Relics. There's also going to be new relics, including one called the Flask of Soma, which will increase your archaeological precision at a price. They don't say what it's going to be.
I like game mechanics that are trade-offs.
There's also going to be... Sorry,
can I... like that's sort of the point we are at the game, right? Like, if you give flat bonuses, you know, there's an end to that, but... If you say you get an even bigger bonus, but at a cost, you know, there's so many possibilities open up. So I'm really excited about that one.
That's what they always say with the Dragonkin lamps as well. It's like you gain experience, but at what cost?
I'm hoping there's an actual cost. And
yeah, we haven't found out what the cost is. We've just been, I've merely, you know, got most of my 99s on Dragonkin lamps. So God knows what's going to happen to me.
At some point, you're going to find out you've sold your soul. Yeah, 100 times over.
I messed up pretty badly there, didn't I?
There's also going to be a way to increase the monolith's power cap.
Well,
it's going to make some people happy.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also going to be a pylon mechanic similar to Caridet, except this time focusing on the dinosaurs. You get a chance to obtain Rex skeletal fragments when excavating, and these fragments will contribute to a paleontological, good God, project. And here we thought we were going to have problems with the Warforged names. We didn't actually say many of those.
Paleontological.
Okay. I don't like big words. Two syllables is my limit. Back at the base camp, and when it's complete, all the volunteers who took part will receive an XP buff to the tune of 25% in the following categories on Anachronia, including Hunter, for big game hunter, butterfly catching, the Jadinkos and the traditional hunter, golden warblers, archaeology excavation, and the XP from the Anachronia agility course will also be buffed with this. And
It's so cool that they go, like, when you ask people about archaeology, like, big dragon, like big dinosaur, not dragon, dinosaur fossils are like a big deal, right? Like that's a big archaeological aspect. So it's really cool that even though Orton, I don't know, itself is going to be about the Dragonkin, it's really cool that they're taking this opportunity to still take this whole fossil dragon? Dino
well,
stuff.
You can do it, you're really...
Dino stuff to it. So I think it's a really cool mechanic. Like it gets us the best of both worlds. So
I quite like how it seems to be focusing on volunteers who took part rather than the pylon buff, which affects everyone in the area.
Yeah.
Good.
Slightly different.
And the same buff will also provide a boost to drop rates for big game hunter, slayer, agility, course codices, and archaeology materials. That's fun.
It's going to be sort of like, from what I read, it's like a Voice of Seven effect across Anachronia, right? Like that's sort of
a general
the...
buff.
Who was it that was saying when Anachronia came out there wasn't enough happening there? Was that you, Tanis, or you, Sirion?
It was Sirion.
Yeah, that sounds like me.
It was you, Sirion, I remember.
Sounds like me. Yeah, no, that's true. There's no real reason to go back.
For well,
Anachronia.
Maybe now there will be.
I hope so. I'm really happy to adding some content to that place.
During some of the early excavations, you get new potion recipes, including the holy agroverload. Oh my god, there we go again!
Holy agroverload. Holy agroverload, Batman!
I need to start making a pronunciation key for these podcasts, coming up with words that are only two syllables long. Summoning Renewal, Archaeology Potion, the Power Burst of Opportunity. What do you guys think that one will be?
Maybe a luck one? I can't remember what Power Bursts are. I know nothing about Herb.
They're the special post-99 potions that come out. They got the Power Burst of Acceleration, the Power Burst of Sorcery, the Power Burst of Master Stroke, and the Power Burst of Acceleration. Which is
so they tend to be potions that give massive bonuses
for
but only
short
for like
10
seconds or 20 seconds and have like a massive cooldown. So like one of them gives you basically infinite surging for 10 seconds or so.
Wow. Maybe it'll be opportunity. Yeah, it might be increased drop rate stuff whenever you kill something.
It's got to be PVM related, right? Because otherwise...
I don't know. I don't think so because three of the five power bursts currently right now are already PVM related. It makes sense to even that out and make the sixth one skilling related. So there's 3-3.
Yeah, because the herbal potions have a 50-50 split between PVM and the rest.
Yeah.
It's like sarcasm.
What's the spirit attraction potion? Any ideas on what that'll be?
That'll be a summoning related one. Spirit attraction. Could be summoning, could be divination would be something else, wouldn't it? That wouldn't be spirit.
Oh, spirit attraction. Time sprite. Or no, spirit? Time sprite?
Could be.
Time spirit.
Maybe.
Yeah,
well,
could
that
be.
Would be
you...
archaeology potion. Yeah. Ooh.
Or maybe a way to increase your Saren spirits.
Oh, bloody Saren spirits.
That could be that.
Yeah, no, I don't have enough big bones yet. I need more Saren spirits.
I've got so many goddamn lobsters.
I never get lobsters. I always get bones.
I always get lobsters.
I always get bones. Bones and Ulogs.
I'm waiting for the next DXP weekend so I can sell them all to noobs.
Yes. And
I've been using all my big bones for the Carapac track.
And Sirion's project will also be coming to game. The skilling offhands are here.
Wait, what?
Yeah. What? Mod Sirion, remember last year?
No.
But are they really coming?
Last year, I made a typo with my mouth that Mod Sirion was working on skilling offhands when it was really Mod Shani right. at the end of the year. So ever since then, we've called the skilling offhands Mod Sirion's project.
Mod Sirion, nice.
I mean, they sound super interesting.
There's really two of them.
I hope more of them are going to come. I hope they are aligned with that project, that Game Jam project.
No, it's an entirely new design.
Again?
Yeah, because the other one, they said the other design was too hard to balance.
Okay.
They're called the Orphan.
That makes me sound like this is going to be not very impactful, because then it's easier to balance. So
like it's called the Orphan Furnace Core.
That'll be interesting.
So that's going to be smithing.
And the Artificer's sure. Measure.
We don't need smithing, though.
That'll be crafting. Artificing?
Is that crafting?
It's kind of magical crafting.
Is it?
Or maybe invention, actually. Artificers, I mean, in D&D, at least, artificers are kind of, clockwork.
Yeah.
Making stuff.
I mean, the Orphan Furnace Core, I think it's going to have to do with how fast your items cool down. Like, that has to have to do with
the heat
mechanic. Artificer's measure. Measure makes me think of crafting, right? Like, you're measuring things.
Yeah. Might be, that sounds like a crafting thing to me.
It's going to be really small and incremental, because we already have the auto heater and the advanced auto heater.
Yeah, and you also have the crystal hammer, so I'm wondering if that's even going to be related to smithing.
True, might not be.
I mean, what else? Wild
speculation.
Be,
yeah. Nice.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, I have no idea on that, but looks like it's going to be another jam-packed dig site, and I'm betting Dragonkin lore, so that's going to be good fun when that comes around.
I mean, I'm super excited about the level range as well. Like, I'm about to hit 99. Like, I'm 200k off. So, for me, this is like perfect timing. Like, I can dig into the first few sites here and make it help me fill those gaps post 99.
Yeah. I'm going to make the push for 110, get 110, finish off Warforge. Yeah, we did this episode before I finished Warforge, but that's okay. And then I'll be ready to progress forward on Orthon, and you'll have a bunch to go back and deal with. So this is good. This will be October 19th. Give us a week of downtime, but you never know what's going to happen next week.
And you can play it on Steam.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Next week's also going to be huge.
So
all your
friends in your friends list can judge you for your addiction.
All right. Well, as you're progressing along, you're obviously also going to be working on the Karapak track at this time. And this was the first Yak track that had lore in it, which I think was a wonderful thing to do. A little bit grindy getting to some of the higher ones, in the 30s and the 40s. But at the end of the day, how do we feel about Karapak track lore and the fact that there's actually lore in a Yak track now?
I like that it's in the Yak track. I, listening to what I suppose it expands a bit on what Mod Warden said in your interview with him, of including lore and story content in as many different aspects of the game that's not just quests, I think this is really, really nice. I have mixed feelings about Yak tracks in themselves. I think they're a really nice alternative monetization method, but they're not my style of gameplay at all, so I don't really engage with them.
Did the lore make you engage this time?
About halfway, and then okay. I just thought, I've got better things to do than burn 2,000 logs. I don't find that fun. It's simple as that. That's not the kind of aspect of the game that I find fun. I can appreciate Yak tracks as an alternative to other monetization methods, but they're just not my kind of gameplay. But that being said, it's great that there's lore in it.
And we don't know yet what the job is going to be after the fact to get the lore from this, because they are going to bring this lore in after the fact for people who didn't do it. And the question is, are they just going to get it, or are you going to have to, you know, go on a mini quest or something to that effect?
Yeah, that's something I'd like to know.
My guess is that you can just do the tasks from the curator and do the things in Anachronia, right?
Yeah,
all in a row.
Yeah, and what these tasks are is that you are given a book and you're asked to go identify various bits and pieces of flora from Anachronia. And it kind of works like a clue scroll where it tells you how many paces you are away from it, but it updates you as you progress along. So they're not too hard to find. And, you know, one of the most interesting parts about this that I thought personally was that, you know, I thought I was just going to, you know, be getting a little bit of text here and there, but there's actually NPC encounters with this. You guys will recall that, I forget what week it was. I think it was the Effigy Incubator week. I said, oh, I wonder when Vindicta is going to come into this. And lo and behold, and, you know.
My beautiful girl, Vindicta. Yay!
Spoilers ahead here for this, if you don't want to have it spoiled. But we're going to talk about it. On the first lore tracker task, or lore hunter task, you wind up listening in on a conversation between Hannibus and Vindicta. They're talking about Iaea, and Vindicta says it was quiet, like a decorated tomb. Everybody just walking around like corpses, resigned to fate. They're not even trying to avert. I had expected more from the mighty dragon riders, a vast and vibrant world, but they treat it like it's nothing more than a grave. And of course, they're talking about the home world there on that front.
Yeah, so it's talking about the dragon, not dragonkin, sorry, the dragon rider, the Ilyunkers' yeah. problem, which is that they are dying out. They're basically infertile. They're no longer producing enough children to survive. And most of the dragon riders have kind of accepted that, and they're kind of embracing that this is their end. So they're celebrating their culture, they're celebrating their history, and kind of moving forward, trying to greet it in a positive manner. Vindicta has been raised in a very, very different way. She was raised by Gorvek, her mother's dragon, and is a Zarosian warrior. Very, very different to the other dragon riders. She's very aggressive and forceful. And a little note
God
later Wars on,
Dungeon
is that she 2. Is, she's from God Wars Dungeon 2, yet she's a Zarosian champion there. She is bigger than stronger than the other dragon riders, and I'm quite glad that they actually put that in there, because her character model is about 3 times the size of her father's. I've always found that hilarious.
Yeah.
but it's actually brought up as a point is that she is physically bigger and stronger than the other dragon riders for some reason. She says it's because I think it's because I refuse to let fate decide what happens to me. Interesting that she says that as a Zarosian, because Zaros is all about fate and doing what your god tells you to do. So that's interesting to hear. But yeah, she comes in with this slightly more aggressive attitude of, why are you accepting your fate? Why don't you fight back? And she's managed to persuade some of the younger dragon riders to come back to Gillinor as pioneers to, you know, here's a new world. Do you want to become the new generation of dragon riders? Like, actually, you know, find a dragon to go, you know, raise hell, whatever they're going to do.
That would be really interesting to see. Why are
we
they on?
We need another quest. We need yeah. another.
Why
Hannibus
are they
quest?
On Anachronia?
Like, come on.
Why are they on Anachronia? That's my question. Why are they in
Hannibus
the middle of
Anachronia? Be in Anachronia because that's where he settled. If you remember, at the end of Desperate
right.
Measures,
okay.
it's where his farm is.
All right.
And
I guess kinda,
just
Vindicta's just visiting him there.
I guess maybe, although maybe she'd have said too. That would be cute.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, who knew when who knew that Vindicta would show up with this? And I think it's fun to explore this. It feels a bit tangential to the whole idea of Karapak, but it's important lore nonetheless. And this tells us, I think, that Vindicta is going to play a role, and the Dragon Riders are potentially going to play a role in the resolution of this storyline.
Yeah, and I do feel like this is a setup for another quest.
This is just wonderful. Wonderful.
It's such
wonderful.
A lovely exchange. Like, I deeply enjoy any Hannibus related content. He's such a nice guy. And, you know, Vindicta, his relationship with Vindicta is something that I love reading about.
Yeah.
So I hope it gets developed on and they get a chance to grow together.
Yeah. Task two was one where you're poking around the base camp and you're talking with Mr. Mordo. And, you know, with this one, I think this is just more about the time element of what happened to the island, right? And Carapac's threat and...
Yeah, it's a little bit of filler. I think this one is kind of,
that's a good way of describing
putting
it.
A bit of spacing between the end of Desperate Measures when the volcano erupted and the Orphan dig site. So it's kind of adding a little bit of temporal padding, I guess, between them. So it doesn't feel like you're going straight from one to the other. And yeah, this is just him kind of talking about the site being in development as well.
Yeah, because... Mordo says, don't you think it's time we started a serious archaeological... there's that darn word again.
Archaeological
investigation of these runes. And you say, wouldn't that be focusing on the past? Mr. Mordo says, yeah, I suppose so. We should focus on the distant past. You say, can I start digging now? Oh, no. There's a lot to do. A lot of work to do first. We need to procure mattocks. There's an incredible amount of paperwork to deal with. And we've run out of archaeological hats. I'm sure you're here when we're ready to go. Of course, that's referring to Orthon.
Yeah. I love how Mordo's written in that one. He's got a really fun voice.
All right. Then this one was a big shock to me. Task 3. Takes place near the black butterflies on Anachronia. You're, you know, tracking around and you follow the various flower paths to a point. And then who is standing in a corner? In a shadow, nonetheless. But Zaros.
Surprise!
This one really surprised me. Did it surprise you guys?
I was really bad at staying out of the spoilers channels on Discord, so I was not surprised.
Zaro says that something will occur in this vicinity, and he is very, very coy. He doesn't say much about it. And Blair asks, "Do you spend much of your time just waiting around?" He says, "I have spent more time waiting than your species has existed. You lack patience. I do not blame you. If my lifespan were as minuscule as yours, I too would rush. I learned patience over the first 1,000 years of my existence." Then talks a bit about the creation of him and Saren by Ma. He says that Saren calls her mother, but she is wrong to do so. And with this, Zaro says that Ma didn't actually create them to be children in her view. And keep in mind, this is how Zaros is seeing this. They weren't even created as servants. Zaros sees himself, or I guess we can say he, and Saren as toys of Ma. And the exact words were misshapen facsimiles of bipedal life that tormented her mind and body. And so much so that Zaros views this as an insult to have been created in this image by Ma, and thought that maybe they were just mannequins and Ma breathed life into them and only used them when she wished to play. And this is, I think, highlighting a good amount of the angst that Zaros had for Ma. And we see that difference in terms of how Saren thought of Ma versus what Zaros, of course, thought of her too. So, I don't know. I think that was new because we didn't really have too much of that before, did we?
A lot of it has been implied before, but this was kind of the first real he's actually talking about his past experience. Quite a bit more brutal than Saren's point of view. And Saren's obviously got a lot of love for Ma because, you know, that's her pure aspect. Zaros is more kind of... Saren is kind of pure emotion and Zaros is completely emotionless. They're like these two extremes. But yeah, you're right. It quite a bit of a surprising thing for him to suddenly start talking about.
Yeah.
But he makes his point that he's very used to waiting to get what he wants.
And
I was quite surprised to see him because we haven't seen him for... Oh, God. Well, he wasn't in Desperate Times. He wasn't in Desperate Measures. I think we haven't seen him properly since Endgame.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, he's also kind of just been in the background of various archaeology things, too. But in terms of
he
when...
He has. He raised the monolith.
Yeah. In terms of so when things are going to happen, he says very soon. But we don't know exactly what that's going to be.
He's doing his usual thing of just lurking, being ominous.
Yeah. Task 4 is Charleston Thok. Once again, continuing off of desperate measures with this one. I haven't done this one, so I'm just going off of the transcript on this. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, it's more of this conversation and the banter that we saw in Desperate Measures. Charles says, I don't think I've ever seen anyone so utterly fail to woo someone. I mean, what were you thinking? Liverworts as a bouquet? They even sound horrible, and that's ignoring the simple fact that they're murderous flowers. Thok says, I thought she might enjoy them. Why? In what possible world does that logic make the slightest hint of sense? Well, she's a Slayer master.
It's Lanikea that they're talking about here.
Talking about Lanikea. And so Thok thought that she would appreciate something that she could slay.
Bless Thok. He tries his best.
Oh, that's funny. Charo says, he says he wooed his paramours with potential murder. And then goes on to a story about people named Lord and Lady Vandercrank. Have we ever heard about these ones? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Just background characters.
Charles wooed them by getting them to plot elaborate murders for one another. And he says, nothing can rekindle a stale relationship like the passion of a creative assassination. I find that too funny. Am I the only one who finds plotting?
Oh, I love Karras. He's just pure chaos.
These two characters, you think that they're, one is perhaps a little bit more serious than the other, but when it comes down to it, they're exactly the same.
Karras has always been portrayed as being a little shit, really. Like, do you remember from the You Are It
right.
drop, lore right. drop, where he was talking about how he got banished from Lord Draken's court? I remember now, he was saying that he released the blood veil. He played basically a prank on Lord Draken, which is a ballsy thing to do. That's why he had to go into hiding and kind of flee across the continent, because he, pissed off the king of the vampires.
Yeah.
He's such a little shit. He's amazing. I love him.
Then Thok says, what about one of the enormous fangs from one of the great big lizards? Sure, that Thok is a mighty warrior equal to her. Charo says, just leave it for now. He says, well, I would love a little more than watch you stab her repeatedly with that spear of hers. I think you need to give her a bit of space. Everyone else is terrified of her, so you're in no danger of someone sweeping her off her feet. Thok says, do women like that? Like what? You're being literal again, aren't you? No, you great squishy troll of a man. Women do not like to be wooed in ritual combat. Boy.
These two characters could be in a D&D party any day.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
what they make me think of. Like, just banter in D&D parties.
Yeah. They're a funny pair. And I didn't, when I first heard it was Thok and Karras, go all the way back to Desperate Times, that are going to start being paired up to, be the quest sidekicks. I thought, there is no way this is going to work. But yeah, they've got some pretty good banter, and they're quite fun to see, spark off each other. So yeah, it's
to me,
good.
this is a great callback. Like, this is what made me, I don't want to say fall in love, but this is what made me like quests and RuneScape, right? Like all this random banter and fun little jokes and all this stuff. I don't really care about this big storyline with Elder Gods. I just give me this, like.
It's the character focus you like, isn't it?
And then give me 5 hours of this, and I, sure, I'll play through it.
And then the final bit that he suggests getting for her is a bunny. And a war bunny. And then, as they continue that discussion, your player leaves them be. And then as we move on to the fifth and final, I think there's only five.
There's a fifth task, and then there's a bit of kind of post-talk. Oh my god, now I can't speak. Post-task dialogue with Saren. And that's where things get very exciting.
All right. Prehistoric Potterington, of course. You have to imagine Maud Raven's voice in this one. Prehistoric Potterington is collecting some fruit for the animals back on the farm. And, you know, she says, I've never been one to turn down good company, but if you don't mind, I'm a wee bit busy at the moment. And then you say, is that it? What do you mean by that it? You say, don't you have an important conversation for me to eavesdrop on? A major revelation, some ominous foreshadowing about the future of Gielinor? Why in blazes would I do that? I'm just out here checking on the, what was it? Yeah, the fruit. Checking? I thought you said you were gathering. Gathering fruit, that's what I said. I don't know what you're getting a tizzy about, plum pudding. Anyway, what a woman does with produce in the privacy of a secluded glove is her own darn business. Don't you have some frogs to collect for, what's her name, Sarah?
Again, fourth wall breaking banter. It's always fun.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a RuneScape-y thing, like taking the piss out of the whole you're here to save the world.
Yeah.
About you being the main character in a video game forming the basis of some of the jokes. It's always fun to riff off that.
Yeah, and this is classic RuneScape, and it's wonderful. And then, you know, you go back, and like you said, you hand this all in to Saren, and then you have this talk about these pieces of lore that you've gathered. And this is an update from Saren on the situation in Anachronia. We have, of course, folks like King Rolf and Zeradar there. And Saren says, the immediate threat's been resolved. I must report the Carapax device was left operational for a prolonged period of time, and his plan was to poison the world's magic and through it every living thing. We knew that from Desperate Measures, of course. We stopped it in Desperate Measures, but she then says, the substance has diffused across the world such that only a trace amount is present, not enough to seriously threaten your peoples, but research conducted by the curator informs me that even a small amount absorbed by the growing plant life could stunt or damage its growth. The next harvest will be a poor one. I urge your people to prepare for famine. Please do what you can to support each other's, and Tyrannan will provide what it can, but our resources are not limited. Now with this, everybody says that they will provide assistance from Lord Dicarius to Osman of Menaphos. And then Saren wants to talk to you in private and says that it's getting worse. And
so this is something we brought up in Desperate Measures, and I said this is going to be a plot point. Look at how Lord Dicarius speaks to Saren. He says, of course, Lady Saren, we will gladly provide assistance if it pleases you.
Hmm.
This is the Zamorakian Night Leader talking to Saren like that. What on earth is going on?
That is slightly concerning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is Saren's aura at work. They're all falling in love with her. They're all wanting to do as she wants. Just by being in her presence, and Saren's recognizing this.
I'd like to have that kind of power.
Oh, no. Because they're not answering of their own free will.
Yeah. She says that this is getting worse. I only call the council together rarely, but each time they're more strongly affected by my auras. And you, as your character, think that they're just cooperating. But Saren says, if there's truly a famine, by working together, we can save many lives. Perhaps maybe I should. No, I'm not my brother. They're not my tools. There is a graver matter to discuss, which I have not shared with the council yet. And it's the eggs. The elder eggs. Carapax wanted to poison them, of course. And he says no. Or Saren says no. He has done the opposite. Saren says, I can feel where the elder eggs are. My three cousins. And the eggs contain in them the next generation of elder gods. Of course, we knew that. And from the moment I first set foot on this world 10,000 years ago, I've been aware of their distant glare, of the distant glare of their life. That has changed. The rhythm of their being. They do not have blood. But if it helps, you could imagine a pulse. It has quickened. And you ask, they're hatching? Aaron says, no, not yet. Carapax's device was not active for long enough to damage them, but it has agitated them. I do not believe they are in any immediate danger, which is why I haven't informed the council. But I believe that another disruption as powerful as the last could wake them. It is good that you stopped the device when you did. Nothing else on Gilar could cause such a disruption, but I thought it best that you be aware.
Yeah, so there's going to be something that is as much of a disruption in the next quest, right?
Probably.
this sounds like massive foreshadowing. Like, don't do that, but it's not going to happen. This should never happen.
So basically, they're the next generation of Elder Gods who have been, in the eggs in Gilanor are starting to hatch. I find it really interesting that Saren describes them as her cousins.
Yeah.
Because
do we take from that a literal sense or a figurative sense?
I think figurative, but Saren and Zaros are both children of Mar, and Mar never laid an egg in the same way that her sisters did. So I suppose you could kind of think of them as kind of in the same level as whatever is in these eggs.
Maybe kind of Saren and Zaros do like this fusion thing where they're like
put their fists
together.
I was thinking about that on the bus on the way back, because Mar stands for her aspect of creation is potential. That's what she is. So with Saren and Zaros, you've got light and dark. You've got these two extremes are different on everything, basically. They are both complete polar opposites. And the difference between the two, obviously, there's your potential. So maybe they're kind of two halves of the same whole in that sense.
I wonder if that's the conclusion we're racing towards, that somehow Saren and Zaros have to sort of join forces and be the counterweight to the other Elder Gods. Because only together they can match that power level. That would be interesting.
But also, Jas's egg has been destroyed. So there's a huge imbalance there. I forgot what Jas stood for, but I think she's the most powerful of the five.
Yeah. Yeah. Could this be what Zaros is waiting for?
Waiting for an egg to hatch?
Yeah.
On Anachronia?
Well, I don't know necessarily on Anachronia. It doesn't matter
full?
Where he is.
Was it full or when? Like, one of the two is in the volcano, right?
That's full.
Yeah, but she's kind of more around the car. Jas stands for progression. I think she's the most powerful of the five, but she doesn't have an egg, a child, or a next revision. If the next revision were to come around, she would not survive it. She would not, be reborn.
Well, then whose eggs are we waiting on then?
Full, Bick, and Wen.
Okay.
The remaining three.
And we really haven't had much to do with Bick or Wen.
No, Full is Constancy and Fire.
Yep.
Bick is Alteration and Earth. And Wen is Inversion and Ice.
Yep.
I think Wen is the Ice Mountain.
Yeah. Where
and
the Oracle
Bick is.
Is
Entrana.
Yep. I think that is what we know. Okay.
So yeah, that's a really exciting thing, and it's obviously a lead up to whatever the next quest is.
Yeah, and I imagine we'll probably... Do you think
only
in Orthanc...
Wait 2 years, right?
Don't say that. They said there's going to be another quest this year.
Not an Elder Gods quest, though.
I hope there's another minor one, at least.
Yeah, there will be a minor one. Do you think
what's
going
to be? Desperate what? What's going to be?
I was hoping it was going to be the Centistan quest, but apparently that's not... It hasn't been cancelled, but it's morphed into something else.
Yeah. Do you think the lore we get from Orthanc will be Dragonkin-related primarily, or do you think we'll also be getting some of this Elder Gods stuff based on Carapax's
machine? I think
Carapax's
they will machine. Stick to Dragonkin. Like, we got so many... lore drops on Dragonkin doing desperate measures, and I mean it was focused around that and we learned a lot, but I think like it, in the end it all sort of got overshown like by the Elder God stuff, right? And I think Orden is really going to be that place where they get their own story, their own context. So yeah, I think it will stay separate. I think we're going to dig into the history of the Dragonkin more. And, the Elder Gods are going to be involved in that because they're so entangled with the Dragonkin history. But I don't think it will be like a lead up to the next quest.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be nice to... Oops, sorry, got a bit too close to my microphone there. It would be nice to see Karapak, actually, at Orphan.
And have a bit of a chat with him about everything that's transpired since. Yeah.
Because where has he been left after Desperate Measures? Yeah. What is he going to do? I know we've had some really nice stuff with the Sendathas, but yeah, it would be nice to get a bit of stuff about him as well. I don't think it's likely though.
And just going back to the Karapak track on that, you know, I think having this lore be tangential to everything else is fine too with the grand reveal at the end. I think that's perfect. So, all right, let's move on to the patch notes for this week.
All right.
Yeah, there's only a few.
We also had an update.
Yeah, we did. We did, and we're going to move through that quickly.
Cause... Almost 2 hours in. Oh, right, we had an update.
Yeah, I mean,
we're an hour and a half. We're doing all right.
Yeah, we're good. The achievement completion sound is more subdued and varied, and pet kittens will now make a different sound when summoned.
Oh,
the things that matter.
Yes. Mobile-wise, fixed an issue that caused the mirror rotation puzzle during Morning's End Part 2 to be rendered as a black screen on mobile.
Still easier than the actual puzzle.
Why would you try to do it on mobile?
I don't know. Change the notifications of mobile chat, and the prismatic dye colors wheel can now be used correctly. A whole bunch of changes to ladders. They say, we like to think we know what you want, and this week, that's ladder improvements. Cast your eyes on some truly astounding tweaks and fixes to the various ladders of Gielinor.
You could say they really stepped up.
No, we're not going to say that.
I'm just going to skip over all these because you said that, but there's ladders in the Cithraid Abbey, Lunar Isle, you no longer go up ladder sideways, ladder climbing animation next to Lunar Isle has been corrected, and an issue has been fixed with the climbing animation on the ladder in Burthorpe. But this week also, engine-based improvements have been made to the Mac client to improve stability. Finally.
Well, that was long overdue, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, you guys don't know how it is if you're playing on a Mac. Some days...
Oh, I do know how it is playing on a Mac. I used to have one.
Yeah, but it was even worse because you'd open up the client and sometimes you might not even make it to the sign-on screen. Or you'd get to the lobby and it would crash. Or you'd start up and it would crash as soon as you got into the game world. And there was literally no way of knowing when it would crash. And it was just really, really annoying. And it was one of the reasons that I seriously took a look at moving the production away from the Mac OS side. I think we're okay now, but we'll have to wait and see on some other Mac OS related things.
It's going to be good. It's going to be good for those three remaining players on Mac.
Well, I needed to do this before the Steam launch, because remember, Steam is on Mac as well.
I think Mac lost most of its gamers by now.
I honestly didn't think the game was actually played on Macs.
So there was this movement, right? Like, when Steam came to Mac, and there was this period where a lot of games came to Mac, and I think it was actually growing. I was like, hey, you know, I can actually play games on Mac. And then, you know, Apple started doing things, and I think that's like with their deprecation of OpenGL on Mac and
OpenGL
a bunch of other things, they have chopped that off by the head, and you know, it's not worth it anymore.
Like, what's expected to happen is that games on the Mac will literally be the same games that you have on iOS once the Apple Silicon Macs come out, because. Yeah. All iOS apps will run by default on Apple Silicon-based Macs unless the developer says no. So any game that you can get on iOS will run on the new Macs when those come out. And that's going to be the future of Mac gaming.
So enjoy your idle clickers and microtransactions and all that stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I was joking back when this announcement was made in the summer. I said, you know, that if this happens, we'd be in a position where the Mac client that was built for iOS would actually be better than the real macOS client. And I don't know what Jagex's plans are for this, because OpenGL is actually also being deprecated on iOS too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have to do something.
Personally, what I think the future of Mac is, like, we have all these new game streaming services, and, you know, I think we are going to move away from native games on Mac to, you know, you just like with your mobile, you're just going to stream your games to your Mac. Like,
yeah.
You're going to use a streaming cloud and use it like xCloud or Stadia or what have you.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be where the Mac platform is going in terms of games.
It's kind of unfortunate, because what else does it have? I mean, they're also losing their pro users with the issues that have the pro audio users, at least, that have plagued the modern Macs that have the T2 chip in them with all the audio processing problems. If you're doing video editing in Premiere or the Adobe suite, you're better off to use a Windows computer, because you can build a system. Say you want to spend that $5,000 on the Mac Pro, you can spend $5,000 on a Windows computer and get the same amount of power with a...
If not more,
if you're using the Adobe suite. And, you know, it really raises a question of what the future of the Mac is, and it's something that worries me greatly. Because, you know, the reason I'm still here is for workflow, because, you know, we do this video version of the show and you see me, you know, flip back and forth between all my various screens, and this, and, you know, the PDF viewer that we use for all this stuff. This is just the workflow that I've built over all these years, and it's, at this point, inertia. I mean, sure, I could probably find a way to do it on Windows, but this just works so nicely as it is right now. And this raises lots of questions about the future of the Mac, I think. And it worries me. But that's a bit of a... I realize that kind of went off the rails a bit into what Mac OS is to me, but that's okay.
But at least you can now play RuneScape reasonably well again.
You can play RuneScape on it now, so that's all. Yeah. What could you possibly want?
Reasonably well with an asterisk, because... there was some UI artifacting that was brought in this week. So I think they made the decision that they'll take the artifacts on the UI over the crafting, or the crashing.
Yeah, a playable game is best. Graphical glitches are generally don't make it unplayable. So
they also realized that they got to effectively render double the resolution on the Mac client, because all the Macs these days have the Retina high DPI display. So it's going to be doing double the work that it does on most computers out there. I could go on and on and on, and it is a discussion that Sirion and I have had, and he has urged me to pull the plug many times, but I have not. Anyways,
yep.
An issue has been fixed that was causing stalled special attack to trigger an attack from the essence of finality without meeting the requirements has been fixed.
Oopsie.
The spell Fire Urns has been unpluralized to be consistent with other lunar spells. It's no longer possible to walk through the walls by Vindicta in the heart of Gielinor. The Santa Claus chat head transparency has been adjusted and fixed. Getting ready for winter, I see. You're now unable to walk through the rocks near the Liverwort on Anachronia. And the Aranya Cave no longer contains flashing lava tiles and holes in the world. Magic Notepaper now works on bananas in the Spirit Shield. The free cam option has been removed when right-clicking on the map icon in Dungeoneering, and it is still available when you right-click the compass, so it was there in two places. A hole has been fixed in the floor west of Prith. It's gone now. Added collisions to the bushes in the gnome maze. And that's it for the patch notes this week. Oh, sorry, one more about the clan system. Entering the motto editor in clan settings and then leaving with the escape key no longer disables the option to open the chat with the enter key. Bit of a weird one there. But that's the patch notes for the week. I think the biggest one there was definitely the Mac client. We'll just wrap this RS News section up quickly as we move on. It is, of course, Gielinor Giving Time of Year for October 10th, World Mental Health Day. And we're having another two-week-long currency event with the tilt that was built based on the Traveling Artisan. So until October the 18th, you're going to be able to get the Traveling Artisan patches, head on over to the Lumbridge Crater, and build all the mental health and unlock, I should say, all the mental health cosmetics that have been around for previous years. And they're still partnering with Rise Above the Disorder, CPL Cell Mind, and the Princess Trust.
Those are some pretty good cosmetics, too. Yeah. I've gotten over the years. They're pretty good looking.
Yeah, and you still get to choose, of course, with that as to what happens or which ones you build. So. All right. Should we move on to the big news? The big news of the week? Maybe the big news.
The big
had a lot
news.
Of big news this week.
It's bigger than Skilling Offhands?
Well, this is big.
The news that makes me very happy as a PMod.
Yeah, this news goes back years for us, talking about RSBot and PowerBot. Because these two sites have been ordered to be shut down as of October 3rd.
Nice.
And these were botting websites that, you know, were the scum of the earth back in the day. And, you know, we always talked about the bot epidemics and whether or not it would actually kill the game. And, you know, believe it or not, before bot nuke time back then, we knew that this was an issue. And PowerBot and RSBot were around even back then. And it's just amazing that it took this long to do, but these websites have finally had the nail driven into their coffin by legal means.
It's interesting. So do you think they're still used in RS3 very much, or is this pretty much an old school problem?
Well, color-wise, yeah. Because, you know, the color bots are still able to be used in RS3.
Okay. Well, I mean, I literally know nothing about how bots work, so I don't.
And you don't want to know how they work.
I don't know.
The very
better
top
at spotting bots in RS3 than they are in old school.
Yeah, because the
technology they have. Because
at the top,
this make a difference for both games.
Yeah, at the top level, there's two different kinds of bots. There's a color bot, and then there's a script injection bot. And the bot nuke in 2011 and the modern RS3 engine killed the script injection bots cold in RS3. Old school still suffers from those, but the few bots we do have in RS3 are color bots, and this should see a bit of a decline on those. But I think the very fact that the organization has been taken away is the important part on this.
It's also the precedent of taking them down by legally saying, you've got to shut this down, is good. So yeah, looking forward to see where they take this. Lots of happy BMOD.
It goes to show how complex it is. So just, you know, you'd think, you know, bots, game, you know, it should be illegal. You should not be able to do that. It's cheating. Go away. But also, you know, What you're using a tool for a game, like what's illegal about it? So I can definitely see that being some complicated legal conversation.
Yeah, they probably went for kind of they wouldn't go for lost income, but it would be like not the individual players using the bot, but the act of providing a service to bot. Maybe that might be how they do it.
It is around that. And, you know, I think when it comes down to it at the end of the day, this just underscores how important of a thing this is. And, you know, looking back on this, this is something that has evolved over time. And I don't know that RS3 of 10 years ago would have been able to handle this and get this done. And I think that's why we're, you know, with the huge mass there is now, it was able to happen.
that's very good news.
All right. Let us move on then. You know, we do a lot of stuff here. And we are currently wrapping up the poll for our movie night. And, you know, this is something that was good fun putting together. But we're going to just thank some Patreon supporters for making this episode possible. This week I'd like to thank Andrew C., Brock H., Cameron, Christian S., Danny W., Diana, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, Jade W., James W., Jason S., Jim M., Joe M., John P., Kevin G., Kyle, Mr. Ling, Nora, Owen L., Rastafa, Ricky A., Samantha R., Soupfinder, a new arrival, Steve D., Stubby, the Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V., Zachary K., and Zant. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly does mean the world to us. And if you're wondering what all this is about, just head on over to patreon.com/rsbnb. There you can sign up for as little as a dollar a month. You get access to our entire back catalog of monthly bits, 27 episodes at this point, talking about everything from the evolution of combat to what the graphics of RuneScape are like, and of course, the Legends of RSBNB update that we did this past summer. All that for as little as a dollar a month, and of course, you help fund the cost for hosting and production of RSBNB update. For our RSBNB update VIP tier, you'll get a special VIP rank on Discord and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month and access to high quality stereo versions of the show. And for $5 a month, you'll receive a shout out each and every week on the podcast and gain exclusive access to the outtakes that we use for the clip show at the end of the year. And, you know, we have, of course, the monthly bit. We have Inside Update. We have the Round Table, which just went out last weekend. And of course, we have movie night. But we've been thinking, what if there was just a little bit more? A little bit more to aim for. And we have that for you guys. So we have two new goals that have been set. The first one is a $200 goal. If and when we reach $200, we will open up a specialized RSBNB update merchandise store powered by Patreon.
What?
And with that, you can expect, it, I don't know, probably shirts, mugs, maybe a mouse pad. I don't know. There's quite a few options we can look at. But as we get closer to that, we will, of course, highlight this. And this will be a creative endeavor going forward. So I look forward to seeing if we can get there. But, you know, the next one, and, you know, with Patreon, you're encouraged to aim high in the sky, and this one we are. If at some point we were to ever reach $500 a month, Tanis, you and I are going to experience some pain. I'll let you explain what's going to happen with that.
How many of you out there are fans of Hot Ones? So if you're unfamiliar with it, this is where celebrities go on the show and they eat really hot wings, and the hotter the questions, the hotter the wings get, and me and Shane are going to do our own version of that. And I hate hot and spicy things, so I'm going to have to make sure I have, like, I don't know, an EpiPen on hand and a glass of milk or something. I don't even know. I hope we make it there, and at the same time, I kind of hope we never make it there. So we'll see.
Why do you do this to yourself?
Everything for the listeners, everything for the patrons.
I've already done a ketchup milkshake, so I guess
that is not happening. I have already said that is not happening due to lactose concerns.
Clear.
Yes.
Coward.
No, it's not. But hopefully you guys enjoy these and it gives us something else to shoot for on this. And yeah, if you want to learn more about this, just visit patreon.com/rsbnb. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
We just drove the nail into ourselves, didn't we?
yeah, it's going to probably hurt really bad. Dude,
I'm already looking at my bank account, seeing if I can, you know.
Say, can we budget for this?
Yeah, and exactly.
We can actually order the same lineup, Shane, and I think it's what we should do. And some of those are like, they don't even get interesting until around like wing 5. And then, I mean, that's like ghost pepper style. So,
can I do it with boneless wings?
More painful. Well, yeah.
Just inhale it.
They let people do it with vegan stuff. I don't know what the hell.
Did you know that I eat chicken wings with a fork and knife?
Why?
I don't doubt it.
I'll see ribs with a chicken, or sorry, with a fork and knife.
Dude, I bet you eat like that dude. You ever seen the dude that does food like reviews, and he's got like his little fork and his little knife, and he has his little napkin, like no matter where he's at, he's like his little crystal salt shaker.
No, I don't
stuff.
Go that far.
Oh, it's hilarious.
He's actually a food critic.
No, I just have very special tastes, and you gotta do it in a special way.
After you do these hot ones, you won't have any taste left. Let's just...
No, they're all...
Your taste buds will have burned off, so...
No, I can handle it.
The thing I'm afraid of is, like, my throat, like, closing up, and that's what I'm...
I put jalapenos in my hamburgers.
I mean, there's two wrong things in that sentence, so...
Anyways.
Jalapenos?
Yeah. All right, we have some more news on the Apple versus Epic front. Initially, it was thought that they would push for a jury trial, but the judge that will oversee this does not want the case to be tried before a jury. Or they told the judge that it doesn't want to be tried before a jury. And this, I think this makes sense because – there's definitely an inherent amount of bias out there. I think that this would probably be tried in the U.S., right?
I think it's more because of the intricacies of the case.
Yeah,
but
that
I don't
too.
Know if I don't know if putting your faith in one person who may or may not be. You never know.
One thing I still trust. I still trust the legal system, but. Yeah, it's going to be going before a judge instead of a jury on this. And they say this is also because jury verdicts are less likely to get overturned on appeal, and because it might be better for the company's argument whether Apple operates an illegal monopoly on its app store and asking that before ordinary people. And Epic...
But the problem is the definition, the way that we define...
Oh, yeah.
Monopoly since the 80s,
right.
that changed.
But the thing is that when you're taken into a jury like that, you're given all the various definitions about what you're to be judging on in that case. And if the jurors can't follow that, they're booted off the case. And, you know, with that, I personally think that the judge method is the way to go on this. I don't know which way this will go now that we have this lined up. What do you guys think?
You know, the more I find out, the more I'm hoping Epic does well. I mean, I'm really anti-monopoly, and Apple just – they've really been seeming to get away with murder for a long time. And somebody had to be like, hey, the emperor ain't wearing any clothes, man. Come on.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it gets dicey with specifically one piece of news that came out last week from what Google is going to be doing. But, of course, this is about Apple and Epic on that front. And... you know, Epic is everywhere at this point, and they can say that they're putting up this fight against Apple, but the question is, aren't they kind of the same, you guys think?
I don't really have any investment in two digital corporations duking it out. Either way, big conglomerates win, so.
I think there's definitely... problems with how Apple conducts its business. That's I could go on a massive rant about just that. But to me, in this particular case, Epic broke their contract. They agreed with the terms of being on Apple Store. They broke that, and now they're upset, quote unquote, because they planned for this, of course, that they can't be on the Apple Store. Like, I'm not against the very concept of trying to fight Apple, but I think the idea that Epic has that they need to put themselves in this victim role is very destructive and very juvenile. Like, yeah. It's not necessary to, yeah, on
is
purpose,
this
plan months ahead.
Epic put out that really childish advert, kind of that Fortnite advert, saying, oh,
yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Childish.
That's the whole thing, right? Like, they're just trying to influence public opinion. Like, look how good we are. We're really doing it for you. But all their actions are really customer unfriendly. Like, they are not a customer friendly company. They're also not a developer friendly company. Like, Epic just breached their contract with Apple. Why would I sign a contract with Epic? Like, they have not shown themselves to be trustworthy in any way. So, in this particular case, I don't hope Epic wins, because I think they're bastards, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, Apple also needs a bit of competition on its front, too.
Well, see, that goes to the heart of what I'm saying. Like, you have to be like a disruptor, like what Epic is doing, you have to be a certain size, right? Or else you're just going to get mowed over. So are they knight in shining armor? No, but you have to. That's the system we built. You have to have a certain
size. I disagree. Like, if you look at the PC market, and the PC, I admit that the PC is more open, you know, it's easier to get started, but like a decade ago or so, it was all just Steam. There were no other game clients out there that were even close to that size. And then Humble came along. Humble Bundles started, they made their own store, and they're a pretty big deal now. Are they the same size as Steam? No. Like, you buy Steam keys on Humble, but, you know, Humble is
a
really
great,
good storefront. It's
yes,
a
really
successful
good storefront. Yeah.
And they have always been nice about it. Like, they seem like nice people. They seem to do the right thing with charity. They seem to do the right thing with supporting indie games. So, to me, that shows you don't have to be a bastard to transform the industry. Because what's going to happen is that, you know, Epic is going to break open the market, and then they're going to be the bastards. So it's just replacing one bastard with another. Like, I'd rather have someone, you know, be more serious about it and be more nice about it. And you don't need to go about breaching contract and terms everywhere and putting out childish adverts and, like, recruiting all your 12-year-olds as your army to go on Reddit and tell how awful Apple is.
Epic's
like,
move
that's
was
happening.
was very Trump-like.
Yes. In a way, yes. So that's sort of like the concern I have with Epic. Like, their strategy, their mindset. Like, it's the same reason as why I hate Facebook more than the other tech companies. It's because the mindset that they have when doing these things is so arrogant and righteous, where they aren't really better than the rest.
Yeah,
I went on a rant anyway.
Yeah, I agree, and it's going to come down to what this judge decides on this. And, you know, there's been many, many big cases in the past where these sorts of things have been litigated.
I know.
On the legal side, I think Apple's got the edge.
What is a poor pro-corporate judge to do when it's two corporations going against each other?
It's not a corporate judge, Tannis. You gotta have faith in the legal system still. And
I think what's going to happen is this is going to drag out for years, because this is going to go all the way to Supreme. I'm pretty sure. Like,
yeah.
This is going to go all the way up. Like, neither of these companies is going to give up. So this is going to go all the way to Supreme. So we're looking at several years here. I think legislation is going to catch up. If not in the US, then in the EU. Because so much is coming out about Apple. We're seeing so much scrutiny. I think by the time this court case reaches its conclusion, things will have changed on the legislative front so much that, you know, the whole point is moot. That's my prediction, at least.
All right. Let's talk about some visual news about selfies. You know.
So explain to this boomer here, what's a selfie?
Well, a selfie is when you take your telephone, your mobile telephone, you pop open the camera, use the front-facing camera, and take a picture of yourself, and send it to people via Snapchat or TikTok in the modern era. And you know what? More than 70% of photos taken in this day and age are on the front-facing camera. And in the past, Androids and even iPhones have done some facial retouching.
You know why that is, Shane?
Why?
Because the only thing people love more than their phones is their own faces.
But, you know, starting with the Pixel 4a and the Pixel 5 from Google, there will be new options available in the camera app for facial retouching. And facial retouching will be turned off by default. The options will be off, subtle, and smooth.
Huh. Hear that, ladies? Don't worry about makeup. You got retouching.
I think the direction here is the opposite. I've seen so many, like, there's this among the more. Like, mostly teenagers, I would guess. There's a lot of... We have all these vloggers and all that stuff, and all this facial retouching happening before you've sent your picture on your favorite social media. I think it's really easy to get an idealized image of other people's lives.
Yeah.
And we as humans like to compare ourselves to other humans. And we, of course, we always compare our own normal versus this retouched and idolized life elsewhere. So it's led to a lot of unhappiness.
Tannis, what was that story we did a few weeks back with the Amazon body scan?
Oh, what was that?
What was that?
I vaguely remember what you're talking about. Well, I think Therion's right. I mean, at some point, we kind of need to call it quits, right, on the whole retouching. I mean, isn't this false advertising? You know what I mean? You don't actually look like that.
Yeah, no, if you want to do that, that's fine. But I think we just need to accept that, you know, people are who they are. And it shouldn't be the standard that you need to touch up your own face to send it on the internet. Like, it feels like there's like, it's not taboo, or there should not be any shame around that. Like, if you want to post selfies, you just post a selfie.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Amazon Halo. You put your phone up and he uses the AR features to body scan you.
Oh, for the BMI? Yes. Yeah. Yes. I remember that now.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound sketchy at all.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I want to see Apple have a feature like this, and I'd like to see it filter down to more Android manufacturers, too.
The fact that they removed the default touching up, or that you have more control over the touching up.
Yeah, that they're doing on the Pixels.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I think it's good, and I think it goes to show that you know, there's this awareness being built, and there's people trying to fix these problems at the root.
Yeah, and you know what many people don't realize is that when your phone takes a picture, it doesn't just take a picture and save it. There is a ton of processing that happens to that picture, and it's just a question of what gets applied to it. Because if you took a picture just from the camera as it is, it wouldn't look very good. It's of software that we got the phone cameras we do now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Like when the Pixel first came out, remember how everybody was like super impressed with like how good the images were? Like, how can it look so good? you did that using a camera that was worse than the one on the iPhone. But the algorithms, the processing is just so good.
Yeah, that it can
really touch up all these images.
Didn't they have a dedicated chip to doing that too?
I think some of the later Pixels do have a dedicated image processing chip, yeah. And that's what they... Like, I still think that the cameras in the Pixel phones, they're probably not even up to par with the iPhone ones. But it's just the software behind it. It's so powerful. It's so good. Like, have you seen those night sight images?
Yep.
Like, they look so good. They look like proper long exposure pictures. But, you know, it's just the same old phone camera that does that.
Yeah,
like, they're going to bring these night image modes to older phones. They're rolling out updates to older phones to make the photos, to make the pictures look better. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah,
like,
I've said that with the hardware that the Pixel is doing, it's a nice piece of hardware that isn't over the top fluffed out. Because my number one thing I really hate about the iPhones is that whenever you look at one of those celebrities who thinks they know everything, they're using an iPhone. I don't want to be using the same device as them. And the only reason I'm still on the iOS side is because of iMessage and the integration with the Mac, honestly.
Yeah, and I think that's like that's what sells the iPhone and the Pixel, right? I think they don't sell the hardware. They don't sell the software. But they sell that synergy. Like, the Pixel camera is Google showing, hey, we've given the world Android. If you play your cards right, this is what you can do with it. Like, it's set. Like, ever since the Pixel came out, it has set a new standard for Android phones. So, you know, that's perhaps more important than actually selling millions of Pixels.
And selling, a phone that's $999. And another good thing that the Pixel 5 and I think it was the 4A that's doing is it's pushing that entry price down even further, which Apple will have
Look what they can do for, what is it, $699? $799?
Yeah.
Look what they can put in a phone for that price.
And if the way things go, if things go as the way they're looking like, you'll get an iPhone 12 mini for that same price next week, which is a 5.4-inch phone.
Yeah, we'll see.
So that's it for tech news, but as you can tell, we're getting ready for next week as well. We're going to move on into achievements right now. Starting off, we have Isilza with 99 Slayer on October 7th, The Lion with 120 Divination on October 6th, V Vivian with 120 or 99 Summoning on the 6th, FE Superjet with 99 Archaeology on the 5th. Dog Says FTW with 120 Magic on October 3rd. And Dennis with 120 Herblore and 120 Constitution on October 2nd.
We have Arendelle 20 getting 99 Slayer on October the 1st. We have Fee Superjet 99 Summoning on October 1st. Iselsa get 99 Constitution on October the 1st. Guy Fleur, I'm not going to pronounce this in the Dutch way because that's not appropriate. That's 99 Summoning on September 30th.
It's French, Guy Fleur, I believe.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
He was a very famous hockey player.
Okay, that would make more sense. Because it is spelled a bit weird.
Yeah, it's French.
Maybe it's just my dirty mind. Anyway, finally, we have Bird is the Man getting 99 Prayer and 99 Ranged on September 29th.
Okay, we have Matt258 with 99 Archaeology on September 29th. Potato with 99 Farming on September 29th. Surge Aurora with 99 Defense on September 29th. One Rib with 99 Cooking on September 28th. Fee Superd. Perchy, sorry about that, with 99 Magic on September 28th. Schnetz, that's a wonderful name, with 99 Strength on September 28th. And Surge Aurora again with 99 Herbdor on September 28th.
Are you all struggling over those Dutch names?
Schnetz, that's a really satisfying word to say.
Then we have Uber Plastic with 99 strength on September 28th. We have the 82nd Airborne with 120 archaeology on September 26th. Delta 99 Dungeoneering on September 26th. Fritz Craig with 99 agility on September 26th. And Truly a Weeb with 99 invention on September 25th. And Ace's Angel with 120 invention on September 24th.
Nicely done. Nicely done. All right, it is pick of the week time, and what have you got for us this week?
So I'm doing pick of the week this week, and I've picked Kentucky Route Zero, which is a game that was first released back in 2013, or the first part of it. The fifth chapter was released earlier this year, so it's now finally finished after a very, very long time. It's an incredibly weird indie interactive novel type game. It's very, very strange and very beautiful.
Oh, interesting.
I've been playing it a lot over the past couple of days. It's the game that you can very easily play at 3 a.m. and just kind of chill your way through it. It's really relaxed and really kind of low stakes, but surreal and strange and very arty. Parts of it do feel like you're in an art gallery and you're looking at something, you're just like, oh, what is this? You just have to sit with it for a while to enjoy it. Gorgeous, gorgeous interactive novel. The music's lovely, the graphics are lovely. It's Americana, surrealism, modern fantasy, magical realism, all sorts of really interesting stuff all coming together to tell, a very strange and beautiful story. $18.99 on the Steam store at the moment on PC.
That's interesting because it you say graphical, and the first sense I get from this is graphic novel.
It's very much like a graphic novel. Like, I'm a big fan of interactive novels. It's a very fun genre I like playing, and I like writing actually as well. And they're usually very genre focused. So you say, oh, here's a sci-fi adventure, or here's a fantasy RPG. This feels like literary fiction in the form of an interactive novel. And I've never come across that before personally. Very experimental and odd, but thought provoking. Great. If you can't sleep, it's a great insomnia game.
Nice.
Very much enjoyed it. Very enjoyed it.
It's amazing. Like, I think we're only at the start of what games can do in this space. Like,
No. The indie scene has been exploding with interactive novels for the past 5 years or so. It's a really accessible medium for game creators. Far more accessible than any other kind of game.
So I have the feeling indie scene, it's just scratching the surface, though. Like, I feel...
If you go onto itch.io or itch.io, they're all over the place. There's loads of really interesting stories being told in this medium. It's worth digging into, and they're often quite cheap as well. So, it's a good thing to start exploring if you're interested.
Maybe I haven't caught up, but when I did my my thesis on narrative games like 5 years ago, it was definitely still sort of in the early stages, but it's showing so much potential, because if you play your cards right, there is such a different effect of reading something where you're often the passive observer versus being an active participant in some story. For me personally, it has made a big difference in experiencing some games much stronger emotionally than reading a book or watching a movie.
Yeah, it's the active participation that makes a lot of difference. And
this
is one game like that. Like, for instance, you'll be given a scenario and you've got four dialogue choices. You pick one and the other ones change, and they pick another one and the other ones change. So you don't get a chance to see what the other stories were. You're picking how the story is told as you go along. Yeah. And it's just so interesting. And it deeply weird and beautiful game. Really enjoyed it.
All right. What have we been up to on RS? Let's start with you, Tanis.
Still yak tracking. I'm getting close, or at least I hope this is close to the end. I think we're around 38 or 39 now.
Ooh.
I know I'm a stretch anyway. And that's pretty much been like all I've done in RF. I've really been soaking in the archaeology task. Yeah, it looks like I'm going to be the last one to hit the O99 now, but that's okay. We'll get there.
Nice. Just, All right. How about you, Sirion?
Yak track as well. I've been taking it a bit slowly. Like sometimes you're just one of these tasks, and you know it's just not fun. And in the end, the game should be about having fun. So yeah, I've been trying to keep myself honest and making sure that I do the task when I feel like them. I've made some really good headway, almost at 99 archaeology. So really, really getting close to all those juicy lore drops about the monolith. Really looking forward to those. Yeah, that's been it, really. I've been quite busy.
Alrighty. Diana?
I've been not playing a lot of RuneScape lately. Archaeology, when I have been, you know, getting Warforged finished up and getting on for Karadet. And with a little bit of Yak Track on the side, but not a lot.
All right, sounds good. For me, 100% Yak Track. I've been in the skill or kill ones. I've been just playing through it. I don't think I'll be able to do that for the later ones. I'm currently on one that's about 3 hours worth, I believe. Task 26, I think it is.
I might have just finished most of that during this episode.
Yeah, there you go. AFK. There you go. But
it's like 3 hours. That's about right.
Yeah,
today.
Pushing forward to 110 archaeology on that. So good fun with that and herb runs here and there. Because, you know, with Yak Track, it appears as though that we're having, like Tana says, a mini gold rush with the herbs and whatnot. So always fun to do the herb runs on the side. But I believe that's it for this episode of Update. So thank you so much, everybody. Next week, we will, of course, be covering the launch on Steam, which is going to be a big, big deal for the game of RuneScape. Also, of course, remember those new Patreon tiers that we put out, 200 for RSBNB Update merchandise, and 500 if you want to see Tannis and myself hurt each other. So we will be aiming towards those in the future.
Can we also... like patron towards a goal so you don't hurt each other if you're like nice people? Can we counter goal that?
I mean, we could, but I don't think that would be as fun. I don't think because you know there are people out there who hate us, so
really.
But, oh, I'm sure that's not true.
Yeah, I haven't got hate mail in a long time, actually, so that's actually good. But it's a topic for another day. If you guys want to subscribe to Update, you can do that by visiting update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, YouTube, and more. Visit update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. Get the podcast automatically delivered to you, including all the nibbles from that Mod Warden episode last week, all of which are out right now. We currently have nibbles out there for what does RuneScape mean to Mod Warden? What does RuneScape's endgame look like? What about removing loot boxes? What about accountability? And of course, the full episode itself, if that's something you're interested in. All of that available and more at update.rsbnb.com. That being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Update. Take care, everyone.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye.